Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. I want to start off with some good news. Drum roll, please. After a century, a voice for the U.S. salt industry goes quiet. The Salt Institute has existed for just over a century, and now it has dissolved. The Salt Institute, the voice of the U.S. salt industry, spent decades questioning government efforts to limit American salt consumption. Michael Jacobson, co-founder of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which bills itself as America's food watchdog, says, "The Salt Institute, as long as I followed it for maybe 30 years, has done nothing but muddy the waters about salt and health. My feeling is, good riddance to this organization." And from nutritionfacts.org, in a related story, continuing with the whole salt deal, don't be confused by big salt. High blood pressure is not the only harmful effect of too much salt. It also has been tied to stomach cancer, kidney stones, bone loss, obesity, and direct damage to our kidneys, arteries, and heart. But when billions of dollars are at stake, the case is never closed. One can just follow the press releases of the Salt Institute. What about the recent study published in the American Journal of Hypertension that found the amount of salt we are eating is just fine, suggesting a kind of U-shaped curve where too much sodium is bad, but too little could be bad too? These studies have been widely misinterpreted, stirring unnecessary controversy and confusion. It basically comes down to three issues: measurement error, confounding, and reverse causality. All this data comes from studies that were not designed to assess this relationship, and they tended to use invalid sodium estimates simply because it's hard to do the multiple 24-hour urine collections that are necessary to get a good measurement. And in the United States, many of those eating less salt are simply eating less food, maybe because they're so sick, so it's no wonder they'd have higher mortality rates. So compiling these studies together is viewed as kind of like garbage in, garbage out. But why would they do that? They claim to have no conflicts of interest. When confronted with evidence showing at least one of the co-authors received thousands of dollars from the Salt Institute, they replied they didn't get more than $5,000 from them in the last 12 months, so no conflict of interest. If instead you look at the trials in which they did the gold standard 24-hour urine collections in healthy people to avoid the reverse causation and controlled for confounders, the curve instead has a continuous decrease of cardiovascular disease events, like heart attacks and strokes, as sodium levels get lower and lower. There was a 17% increase of cardiovascular disease for every gram of sodium reduced per day. You might note that Americans usually eat between 3 and 6 grams of salt a day. And this is all for people without high blood pressure. We'd expect the benefit to be even greater for the 78 million Americans with hypertension. Unfortunately, the media has widely misreported the findings, and a false sense of controversy has been broadcast, confusing the public. But it's not just the media. When editorials are published on the subject in some of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, you don't expect them to be written by someone who got paid personal fees by Big Salt. Before she accepted money from the Salt Institute, the author was accepting money from the Tobacco Institute and was a frequent expert witness in defense of Philip Morris and other tobacco companies. So if that's who the New England Journal of Medicine chooses to editorialize about salt, you can see the extent of industry influence. The editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Hypertension himself worked for many years as a consultant to the Salt Institute. Well, from an evolutionary perspective, salt is unnatural. For 99% of human evolution, salt was scarce in the human diet. We evolved to have highly efficient sodium-preserving bodies. We can survive perfectly well on 200 milligrams of sodium a day. The typical American consumes 20-plus times that amount each day. Is it any surprise that for older Americans, it is actually unusual to not have high blood pressure? And this is a global problem. In modern times, salt is widely available, a cheap and easy way to spice up foods, and we pay the price for it. 1 in 3 people in the world have high blood pressure. It is important to note that for heart disease and stroke, the lower your blood pressure, the better. Your risk for heart attacks and stroke drops continuously down to a blood pressure of about 100 over 60, which happens to be the normal lifelong blood pressure of indigenous peoples eating traditional diets with no added salt. So the bottom line is this: the less salt, the better, even if you do not have a diagnosis of high blood pressure. Enough of salt, though. I'd like to use salt as a segue to our next segment, the 3 most dangerous food additives. So, what are the 3 most dangerous food additives? If you guess salt is one of them, then you have been paying attention. So what are the other 2 most dangerous food additives? Drum roll, please. Added sugars and added fats. Together, added salt, sugars, and fats are the cheap and unhealthy foundation of the modern processed foods industry. Added fats and sugars make up about 40% of the calories in the American food supply, packing lots of calories while offering very few nutrients. Added fats and sugars crowd out nutritious whole foods and profoundly dilute the health-giving powers of whole foods that are present in the diet. The ultra-refined and overprocessed American diet is capped off with refined grains, which when considered with added sugars and fats comprise most of our diet. Only about 12% of grains eaten in the United States are whole grains. The U.S. recommendation for whole grains is that at least half of grains eaten be whole grains. Almost nobody meets that recommendation. As a side note, the brouhaha over whether carbohydrates are good or bad is really more about whether a carbohydrate is in whole food form or refined. There's no need to worry about eating sugar in the form of whole fruit. There is no need to worry about consuming carbohydrates in the form of whole grains. The divide between disease-producing and health-promoting is basically the divide between eating foods in whole food form or in an overprocessed, so-called refined form. Now, back to the 3 most dangerous food additives. There are thousands of different food additives, and it can be dizzying to try to even begin to sort through them. However, this is a case of counting your dollars before your pennies. Cutting down on salt and added sugars and fats is more important than all of the other food additives combined. So feel free to worry about the dizzying array of weird-sounding ingredients on nutrition labels, but make sure that you have first gotten a handle on limiting salt, added sugars, and fats. Better yet, try eating lots of foods that don't even have nutrition labels, such as fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, let's get on with the public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Does the news make you depressed? If so, I'm sorry about that. But today, I am going to start with some good news, some hopeful news. First up, Could a Green New Deal make us happier people? This from The Intercept. For as long as climate change has been a part of America's national consciousness, it's been talked about in dire terms, evoking images of some hellish Mad Max-style dystopia. But could a plan to curb emissions also make us happier? Could the things we cut back also be the things that make us miserable? If you buy scientists' claims that an economy-wide mobilization is the only thing that can stave off full-blown catastrophe, there are some obvious reasons to believe that a Green New Deal, the only call for that on the table, will make us happy, at least in the long run. Averting civilizational collapse, that is a happier outcome than the alternative. Provisions like a federal job guarantee, improved public transportation, and reining in pollution could improve millions of lives in the shorter term. A growing body of research, though, points to some more unexpected reasons why a Green New Deal could make us more cheerful. People who work less also emit less carbon dioxide. Americans have come to work more, and what effect that has on how people spend their dwindling leisure time, namely by doing more shopping, a habit spurred on by copious corporate advertising. Many potentially satisfying leisure skills are off limits because they take too much time, participating in community theater, seriously taking up a sport or a musical instrument, getting involved with a church or community organization. We have gotten ourselves entrenched in a cycle of work and spend, a cycle of long hours, and a consumer mentality as a way of life. Things didn't necessarily need to turn out this way. At the start of the Great Depression, John Maynard Keynes famously predicted that work weeks could dwindle to just 15 hours as people opted for more leisure time, their material needs being met, and then some, as living standards rose. Combined with rising automation, many expected that shorter work weeks were all but inevitable. Yet years later, work hours in the United States have ballooned and remained stubbornly high. Though global phenomena, the effects of each have been felt acutely in the United States, an oddly tired man out among wealthy countries. Most high-income countries have substantially shorter work weeks and significantly smaller carbon footprints than the U.S. For example, the average German worker toils 23% fewer hours than their American counterpart, and the average German emits 46% less carbon. Shorter weeks can go hand in hand with a job guarantee, too. If each person works less, there are more useful jobs to go around. Researchers measure happiness based on six specific categories: gross domestic product per capita in terms of purchasing power, life expectancy, social support from networks of friends and families, having the freedom to choose what you do with your life, generosity, and perceptions of corruption, and both positive and negative affect, or how often people report experiencing positive or negative emotions. What makes Americans so unhappy? We found that only one of the six factors has grown, income per capita, and that's contributed to helping happiness, but only by a small amount. It's been offset by a declining sense of freedom and generosity and an increase in perceived levels of corruption. People overestimate the amount of happiness you're going to get from more income or more consumption, and underestimate the happiness they get from more time with family and friends. On average, the carbon footprint of the average American is more than twice that of residents in the world's happiest countries. They also work 330 hours less each year, about 41 fewer days. But less obviously green investments also go a long way toward their residents to live less carbon-intensive lives and creating a built environment to make them both possible and pleasurable. State-supported dense and affordable housing, for instance, critical to building a low-carbon world, can encourage people to work and learn closer to where they live. Well-funded public housing in other parts of the world includes things like kindergartens, bars, and restaurants, the kind of social infrastructure that enables hyper-local communities to grow and thrive. Just 7% of Americans currently use public transit to commute, and much of the carbon cost embedded in things like education and even sports, stem from the fact that people in many parts of the country use cars to reach them, lacking any viable alternative. Happy countries' investments in collective consumption and their shorter work weeks allow for a whole host of activities that make us happier and happen not to destroy the planet. The things that bring us the most joy also don't tend to spew greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. These generally involve some kind of human connection. Intimate relations and socializing after work take the two top spots. Volunteering also ranks highly. And people who get more sleep are generally more satisfied with life, as well as healthier than their overworked and underslept counterparts. So provided we're not filling up a gas tank to get to them, our favorite creature comforts, socialization, sex, and sleep, simply aren't carbon intensive, ensuring that we don't just seek out more polluting, less gratifying things to do with our leisure time isn't a matter of buying the right car or light bulb. It's about building a society that makes low carbon and altogether happier life possible for everyone. It's worth noting that, for the most part, the world's happiest countries by ranking are social democracies, or at least far closer to that model than the United States. Aside from investing more money in the kinds of public goods above, they also tend to treat things like health care and child care as basic rights. Relatedly, they're far less unequal than in the United States. As workers have more ownership over the means of production, democratic socialism may well make people happier still. Researchers have observed a systematic relationship between happiness and employees seeing their co-workers and immediate supervisors as partners rather than as bosses. The principles of most cooperatives are exactly the principles that make people happy. They like to work in an environment where everybody is on the same team, where the interests of workers, shareholders, and customers are aligned. Researchers found that workers who have less control over their jobs are more prone to mental illness and binge drinking. By being relatively protected from domination and exploitation, work characterized by authority, autonomy, and expertise may offer protection from psychosocial risk factors for mental illness and drinking outcomes. It isn't big government that gives you happiness, nor is it small government. It's the right kind of government. You want a government that people believe in. If you're in a high-trust environment, people don't fight about which policies to implement, at least not to the extent that we're used to here in the United States. It's also hard to argue with the fact that ensuring people's basic needs are met for food, health care, housing, child care, and more creates the conditions for a happier life, and far more directly than simply raising per capita income. It may not be a coincidence that the places where these things are treated as basic rights are also generally ahead of the curve on climate. The Green New Deal components that its critics have decried as wasteful add-ons, social housing, a federal job guarantee, universal health care, are anything but. Offering decent wages for less work is also a good way to entice people away from poorly paid jobs in carbon-intensive supply chains like Walmart, the largest employer in 22 states, and for many, one of the only options on offer to pay the bills. And people working less leaves more time for the things that actually makes us happy, reducing demand for the cheap consumer goods Walmart pumps out. Eliminating unemployment further means eliminating a major driver of unhappiness, because if being overworked makes people unhappy, being unemployed may be worse still. A Green New Deal isn't about subbing out one form of energy for another as all else remains equal, and there's plenty of inequality to be rooted out. It's about building a carbon-free America. If we succeed, that country will also be a happier one. In a world where no one is compelled to work more than 4 hours a day, every person possessed of scientific curiosity will be able to indulge it, and every painter will be able to paint without starving, however excellent his pictures may be, Bertrand Russell wrote in 1932, arguing for shorter work weeks amid a deepening depression. Modern methods of production have given us the possibility of ease and security for all. We have chosen instead to have overwork for some and starvation for others. Hitherto, we have continued to be as energetic as we were before there were machines. In this, we have been foolish. but there is no reason to go on being foolish forever. Next up, in a related story, when people downsize to tiny houses, they adopt more environmentally friendly lifestyles. This from theconversation.com. Interest is surging in tiny homes, livable dwelling units that typically measure under 400 square feet. Much of this interest is driven by media coverage that claims that living in teeny homes is good for the planet. Newly constructed homes in the United States generally have a larger average square footage than any other country in the world. In 1973, the average newly constructed U.S. home measured 1,660 square feet. By 2017, that average had increased to 2,631 square feet, a 63% increase. This growth has harmed the environment in many ways, including loss of green space, increased air pollution and energy consumption, and ecosystem fragmentation, which can reduce biodiversity. The concept of minimalist living has existed for centuries, but the modern tiny house movement became a trend only in the early 2000s, when one of the first teeny home building companies was founded. Teeny homes are an innovative housing approach that can reduce building material waste and excessive consumption. There's no universal definition for a tiny home, but they generally are small, efficient spaces that value quality over quantity. People choose to downsize to tiny homes for many reasons. They may include living a more environmentally friendly lifestyle, simplifying their lives and possessions, becoming more mobile, or achieving financial freedom, since tiny homes typically cost significantly less than the average American home. Among 80 tiny home downsizers located across the United States, the average ecological footprint was about 9.5 acres. This means that it would require 9.5 acres to support that person's lifestyle for 1 year. Before moving into tiny homes, these persons' average footprint was 17.3 acres. The average American's footprint is 20.8 acres. So, downsizers cut their ecological footprint in half. Downsizing people were more likely to eat less energy-intensive food products and adopt more environmentally conscious eating habits, such as eating more locally and growing more of their own food. Participants traveled less by car, motorcycle, bus, train, and airplane, and drove more fuel-efficient cars than they did before downsizing. They also purchased substantially fewer items, recycled more plastic and paper, and generated less trash. To take these findings a step further, about 366 million acres of biologically productive land could be saved if just 10% of Americans downsized to a tiny home. Now, if you're wondering what 366 million acres is, the state of Ohio is about 26 million acres. So that 366 million acres of biologically productive land that could be saved if just 10% of Americans downsized to a tiny home, that represents the landmass of over a dozen states of Ohio. And in our next story, speaking of the great state of Ohio, scientists say they have found a viable replacement for petroleum-based plastic. Scientists at Ohio State University say they have developed a viable alternative to petroleum-based plastic food packaging by using a natural tree-based rubber. According to the researchers, the new biodegradable material holds promise for fighting the world's growing plastic pollution problem, as well as for helping curb our reliance on fossil fuels. Finding a replacement for petroleum-based plastic food packaging has been a major challenge to date, and nearly all the solutions proposed either too expensive or too brittle to stand up to the demands of shipping, handling, and the stress of microwaving and freezing. Go Ohio State University. Okay, and a little bit of change of pace. Next up, Medicare for All and its rivals, new offshoots of old health policy. The leading option for health reform in the United States could leave 36.2 million persons uninsured in 2027, while costs would balloon to nearly $6 trillion. That option is called the status quo. Other reasons why equivocating is a poor choice include the country's decreasing life expectancy, the widening mortality gap between the rich and the poor, and rising deductibles and drug prices. Even insured persons fear medical bills. Commercial pressures permeate examination rooms, and physicians are burning out. In response to these health policy failures, many now advocate single-payer Medicare for All reform, which until recently was a political non-starter. The benefit package would be comprehensive, providing first-dollar coverage for all medically necessary care and medications. The single-payer plan would use its purchasing power to negotiate for lower drug prices and pay hospitals lump-sum global operating budgets, similar to how fire departments are funded. Physicians would be paid according to a simplified fee schedule and receive salaries from hospitals or group practices. Similar payment strategies in Canada and other nations have made universal coverage affordable even as physicians' incomes have risen. These countries have realized savings in national health expenditures by dramatically reducing insurers' overhead and providers' billing-related documentation and transaction costs, which currently consume nearly one-third of U.S. healthcare spending.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Next up, the opioid crisis is partly fueled by insurers and employers' approach to back pain. This from Stat News. At some point in their lives, 80% of adults will experience lower back pain. It's the second most common reason that adults see a doctor, and the most common reason for disability. It is also a microcosm of all the things that are wrong with the U.S. healthcare system, including its contribution to the opioid crisis. Among the worst is doctors' decisions to write opioid prescriptions as a treatment for lower back pain and their patients taking these drugs. Lower back pain is one of the most common reasons for an opioid prescription. But here's the kicker. There's no evidence that opioids are effective at treating this problem. At best, opioids mask pain in the short term. It's like turning up your car's radio to drown out the horrible noises coming from under the hood while you drive. The radio might distract you, but the car's underlying problem isn't getting addressed and could cause serious harm. And taking opioids for lower back pain often means its cause is being ignored. What works best for lower back pain is a combination of education and proper exercise, not the overprescription of opioid painkillers. Yet to this day, health plans pay for such non-evidence-based interventions like opioids and make it difficult and expensive for patients to access evidence-based interventions such as physical therapy. That doesn't make sense until you look at the reason. For the carriers that administer health insurance plans, there is far more profit in pills than physical therapy. Our entire healthcare system is built on a vast web of incentives that push patients down the wrong paths, and in most cases, it's the entities that manage the money, insurance carriers, that benefit from doing so. By being more concerned about profits than patients, most insurance carrier plans are flooding our society with addictive drugs, and employers are blindly buying in. An estimated 700,000 people are likely to die from opioid overdoses between 2015 and 2025, making it absolutely essential to understand the connections between insurance carriers, health plans, employers, the public, and the opioid crisis. We will never get out of this mess unless we stop addiction before it starts. And lastly, from Science Daily News, mindful body awareness training during treatment for drug addiction helps prevent relapse. A novel type of body awareness training helps women recover from drug addiction. It's the first time the mindfulness approach has been studied in a large randomized trial as an adjunct treatment. The training helps people better understand the physical and emotional signals in their body and how they can respond to these to help them better regulate and engage in self-care. We could teach this intervention successfully in 8 weeks to a very distressed population. And participants not only really learned these skills, they maintained increases in body awareness and regulation over the year-long study period. The training included one-on-one coaching in an outpatient setting, in addition to the substance use disorder treatment the women were already receiving. Women were tested on a number of factors, including substance use, distress craving, emotion regulation, and mindfulness skills. There were lasting improvements in these areas for those who received the intervention. Well, that concludes our show for today. If you'd like to send any feedback, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some